Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. The New York Times calls the book Red Card an engrossing and jaw-dropping tale of international intrigue, culminating in dozens of individuals and companies associated with professional soccer being brought to justice. The author is Seattle native Ken Bensinger, investigative reporter for BuzzFeed, and he's going to join us in about 15 minutes. I hope you can stay with us. First, our top story. Earlier today, President Trump doubled down on something he'd tweeted over the weekend.
If we don't get border security, after many, many years of talk within the United States, I would have no problem doing a shutdown. It's time we had proper border security with a laughing stock of the world.
The president is talking about a government shutdown, something Congress will be faced with in September when another spending deadline hits. If Democrats don't vote on money for the wall and overhaul the U.S. immigration system, President Trump is threatening a shutdown. One of the Democrats who's been working on immigration reform and who'll be voting on the spending deadline is Representative Derek Kilmer. He represents the 6th District, which includes the Olympic Peninsula, most of the Kitsap Peninsula, and most of the city of Tacoma. Representative Kilmer told me that in a district like his, where the federal government is a major employer, a shutdown can be damaging.
It means that the national park gets closed when there's a government shutdown. The people who work at Naval Base Kitsap either are told not to come to work or have to come to work without pay. There's substantial ramifications to the economy when that happens. The last time there was a long-term government shutdown, it came at a cost of literally tens of billions of dollars to the American economy. So I think it's foolhardy to cheer on a government shutdown. That is not something that I'm supportive of. And beyond that, I think I've got great disappointment that the president's focus on immigration seems so narrow.
Well, what is he trying to trade off for his border wall funding regarding immigration? What's the trade?
Well, it's hard to get into the head of the president on this one. If the trade is, and I'll sign a government spending bill, that seems like a really odd thing to trade off, because this is simply, do you want to keep the lights on after the last day of September or not? And, you know, I think the notion that government would function, that you would avert a government shutdown, that's not a Democratic notion. That's just a common sense notion.
Well, in the past, the president has seemed to signal that he would, for example, be willing to trade some kind of status for DACA recipients, the so-called Dreamers, in exchange for some border wall funding. And some people have said to Democrats, look, don't score political points, that those are real human beings, and maybe you have to make that trade, Congressman.
So I'm a sponsor of a bill called the DREAM Act that would provide a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers. I'm a sponsor of a bipartisan bill called the USA Act, which would make some targeted investments in border security that would put some dollars towards trying to address some of the causes of migration at our southern border, looking at providing some foreign assistance to Guatemala and other Central American countries where you're seeing this out-migration as a consequence of gang violence and other instability, and would provide a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers. That's a bipartisan bill. The reality is Democrats have put on the table a number of proposals that would address the challenges and uncertainty facing Dreamers. There was a bipartisan proposal out of the Senate that I think, had the president gotten behind it, you would have seen it pass into law, and you would have provided some certainty to Dreamers. It included investments at the border, as the president has called for. It included some changes to our system of legal immigration as well. That was a bipartisan proposal that came out of a gang of eight on the Senate side. And unfortunately, the White House decided to lobby against that proposal and killed it.
Talking with Representative Derek Kilmer, representing Washington's 6th Congressional District, you're not in a deep blue district. You had Clallam, Grays Harbor, and Mason counties vote for Trump in 2016. What are those constituents generally telling you about their satisfaction with the president so far?
So I think what you saw in 2016 was a real discontent with the status quo, in part because in those counties, they have not enjoyed the economic recovery, certainly that folks here in Seattle have seen and even some of the other urban areas of our state. And so I think what you saw was a desire for change, a desire to see if a greater focus on the economy. Now, on
the economy, 4.1% growth in the second quarter.
So I think you have to have a distinction, and Lord knows I'm rooting for economic growth, but you have to have a distinction between the prosperity that you're seeing here in the shadow of the Space Needle and what you're seeing out on the Olympic Peninsula in the area that I represent. Unfortunately, a lot of the communities that I represent have not enjoyed that economic recovery, and I think there's a discontent with the approach that the administration has taken, in that you've seen a tax bill that by and large doesn't help the people I represent. You've seen an approach to trade that has become a real threat. We were out talking with folks in our shellfish and our fisheries. They're very, very concerned because these tariffs are negatively impacting their business and negatively impacting employment. I was in Elma meeting with a group of dairy farmers. They're concerned because much of what they produce gets turned into powdered milk and exported to Asia. Everyone from the ag industry to our fisheries to other industries are really concerned about the approach that the president has taken to trade. And I'll mention also some missed opportunities. You've not seen a focus, despite a lot of rhetoric around infrastructure and investments in roads and sewers and broadband, out of the administration and out of this Congress. You've seen very little action on that front. In a district like mine, even though we're a stone's throw away from King County and Amazon and Microsoft, the district I represent ranks in the bottom 20% in the country when it comes to access to high-speed internet. And one of the only ways that you can overcome geographic remoteness is through technology, and in a lot of the communities I represent, we don't have that. And as a consequence, you've seen a continued challenge economically. You know, this is where I come from. I grew up in Port Angeles, and I think there's a real strong desire on the Olympic Peninsula to ensure that our top export isn't young people. We want to make sure that there's more economic opportunity for more people in more places. And so far, that's not the approach that's been taken by this administration, much to my chagrin.
Can you understand why the National Republican Congressional Committee put out a list of targeted districts last year, the ones they think they can win, and you're on there?
Well, you know, what I generally do is focus on my job. And I think the best way to keep a job is to just do the job. And, you know, I worked in economic development professionally. Much of my focus within my district is trying to figure out, how do we get this economy on the right track for my region? And how do we get this Congress on track, too? I think you've seen way too much partisan bickering and not enough focus on solving problems for our country. And
in fact, you're part of the House Problem Solvers Caucus?
Yeah, that's right.
Is that I'm not used to hearing about bipartisanship in Congress. This is a group of both Democrats and Republicans. What are you doing with that group to counter gridlock,
yeah,
and partisanship?
I'm part of two groups. I co-chair a group called the Bipartisan Working Group, which is a group of about a dozen Democrats and a dozen Republicans who meet each week for breakfast. We talk about big, hairy issues where we might be able to work together. So as an example, we've passed a VA reform bill that came out of that group, where we had the Government Accountability Office come and meet with our group and talk through some of the areas where they found problems with the Veterans Administration. And the question was asked during that meeting, so what has the Department of Veterans Affairs done with this report from the GAO? And the response was nothing. So we wrote a bill collectively, Democrats and Republicans, focused on making some reforms to the VA, and it was a bill that got broad bipartisan support. Now, you also mentioned the Problem Solvers Caucus that I'm a part of, and that group is doing something that I think could be very, very important for the coming year. And that is, we've just come out with a reform package called the Break the Gridlock Package that proposes about a dozen reforms to House rules in an attempt to have an approach that is more focused on consensus building, on having debate in Congress, so that, you know, when you see a once in a generation tax proposal, rather than seeing it brought to the floor without much in the way of debate, and rather than having it not be open to amendment, that there would be an opportunity to shape that discussion. And I think that's a really important conversation because oftentimes, you know, both in the media and in Washington, D.C., the focus is on the who, right? Who's going to be in charge? Which party is going to be in charge? I think it's really important to ask the question how. Regardless of which party is in power, how are we going to have a functional legislative branch that's actually solving the needs of the American people? How are we going to make things work regardless of which party's in charge? What's unique right now is because there's uncertainty about the midterms, you don't know which party is going to be in charge. And that actually provides a unique opportunity now to propose some changes to the rules where you could see some bipartisan consensus, again, because you don't know whether you're going to be in the majority or the minority.
My guest is U.S. Representative Derek Kilmer, representing the 6th Congressional District in Congress. I want to bounce off you one idea for making things run better in Washington. Maybe the Republican running against you, Douglas Dightman, on KXRO last week said this.
I've already pledged I'm going to run for a single term because I think that's what we need to do is we need to draw on the experience from people in the communities and all different walks of life that can go back to Washington, D.C., represent their constituents faithfully and not have it be their lifetime job, have it be something they go do as service for a couple of years.
What about that idea? Do your job a little bit and then say you're going to leave, Congressman.
Well, I think if Congress doesn't get its act together, you're going to see a whole lot of terms limited by the voters. And again, what I believe is that there's an opportunity to reform the way that Congress does business. Let me give you some examples. So far, you have not seen, even where there is bipartisan agreement, this Congress take up those bills. So there's an immigration reform bill that if it was put on the floor for a vote, I think would get more than 300 votes. One of the proposals that is part of this Break the Gridlock reform package is to say, if you have a proposal that has broad bipartisan support, let's make sure it gets a vote. Let's give an opportunity to, in essence, fast track a bill that has bipartisan support out of committee or broad bipartisan co-sponsorship. Let's make sure that gets a vote.
And then, just to put you on the record, then, yeah. What about your Republicans' advocacy of term limits? He said one term in his case, but do we need more turnover in Congress?
Well, I'm certainly an advocate of some turnover in Congress right now, particularly because I think this Congress is headed in the wrong direction. But let me give you an example. So, I the largest employer in my district is Naval Base Kitsap. One of the concerns that we've seen out of Naval Base Kitsap stemmed from back in 2014 when the Defense Department changed its approach to per diem, where if you were asked to travel for long periods of time, not only were you asked to be away from your family, but the Defense Department proposed cutting your travel reimbursement, your per diem, by 25% if you traveled for more than 30 days, and by 45% if you traveled for more than 180 days. I proposed a bill back in 2015 to change that, and we were able to get it out of the House year after year after year, and we were stymied in the Senate. Now, 4 years into that process, last week the House passed a defense bill that finally makes that change, that finally says we're not going to nickel and dime defense workers when they're asked to travel for work. That took 4 years. If you limit yourself to only being on the job for 2 years, I think it hinders your ability to get things done on behalf of your constituents. Sometimes the wheels of the legislative process, to my chagrin, work much slower than I would want. And I worry a little bit about, in an environment where people are there for such a short period of time, my fear is that simply empowers the special interest groups who have longevity and who've been there for a long time to run the show. I think special interests have too much power in our politics right now. To me, the important thing is to have a political system that meets the needs of the people, whether that be defense workers in Kitsap County or whether that be timber workers in Clallam or Mason County. I think that is my job as a representative, is to go to work on behalf of the people I represent, not to empower special interests.
Congressman Derek Kilmer, thank you for coming in.
You bet.
Democrat Derek Kilmer represents the 6th District, Olympic Peninsula, most of the Kitsap Peninsula, most of Tacoma, talking to you about immigration, bipartisanship and the president's tweets. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. I hope you'll join us. So we all had a lot of fun this month watching the World Cup soccer games from Russia. So much fun that it was tempting to forget how the World Cup got to Russia. The system was rigged by soccer's governing organization, FIFA, and some of its member countries, and it took the United States to uncover it.
An unprecedented crisis for FIFA. A US investigation into football's governing body found it took bribes worth hundreds of millions of dollars over more than two decades to allocate tournaments and fix elections.
The fuller story is told in a new book by a Seattle native, actually. Pulitzer Prize finalist Ken Bensinger is an investigative reporter at BuzzFeed. The book is Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. Welcome, Ken.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
By the way, Seattle even played a little tiny part in the soccer money laundering
That's story. True.
Yeah. We'll get there. Okay. First of all, Ken, you call soccer the most corrupt sport in the world. Why is that? Why is soccer so corrupt?
Soccer happens to be the most popular sport in the world as well as the most corrupt, and I think those go hand in hand. It's extremely popular. We here in the States sometimes forget, but if you could imagine in countries like Brazil or England or France or all of Europe basically and most of South America, if you took every sports league in the U.S., every sport in the U.S. and combined them into one thing, that's all the people care about. And that's what it's like in those countries. So it's incredibly, the cultural currency of the sport is gigantic. And it actually has great economic and political power in those countries as well. And with that incredible muscle and popularity comes a lot of money. And unfortunately, in so many human endeavors, with so much money comes a lot of temptation for corruption. And because of the reach of this sport, it's played in 200 plus countries in the world. It's everywhere. The corruption is everywhere. It's hard to find anything, no matter how corrupt, that's that broad-reaching.
Well, I mean this to sound as ignorant as it is, because I don't understand it really, but it's just a game. So I know, as you said, it's hugely popular and lucrative and international. But does that mean it has to be allowed to be that corrupt, or why did it? And if not, why? Why has it been so corrupt for so long and allowed to stay that way?
Right. It wasn't corrupt for many, many years, or at least not in a big way.
Oh, really?
But it became corrupt when big money came into the sport. So in the 1970s, until about 1975, that around then, the sport was pretty quiet, not a lot of corruption happening. And then the big corporate interests came in, the Coca-Colas, the Fuji films, and then the television. So a few years later, when the technology improved for international color simulcast broadcasting, suddenly massive mountains, oceans of money start pouring into the game. And the people who are the middlemen, the brokers of all these deals, end up discovering that they're better off paying bribes than allowing things to compete in sort of an open market. And so ultimately, the corruption in the culture of the sport comes from the desire of middlemen to make more money off the sport and to deny it sort of a free market approach to it. So we see this, it's basically a controlled, cheated market where bribes are paid to keep people out.
Would you give an example of how colorful, how creative and epic this bribery can become? You have so many stories in your book. Give us a flavor.
Yeah. So, I mean, the bribery ends up becoming a very complicated, sophisticated system over the decades. And you're having bribes on almost every commercial deal, almost every television deal. And you're having people go to great lengths to hide this because they know that it's not okay. They know that no matter what they say, it's not all right. So one example would be that there was a Paraguayan who was taking millions of dollars in bribes, but he didn't want to get caught.
Bribes for what?
For signing contracts that would cede commercial rights to tournaments, right?
So okay.
he was in charge of a part of all of South American soccer rights. So he would sign over television deals and sponsorship deals and would take millions of dollars in bribes to steer them to one company or another. Mm-hmm. But he didn't want to be connected to the bribes. And so he would ask for them in cash, but he didn't want to travel across international borders with cash either. So he would have his personal driver drive from Asunción, Paraguay to Buenos Aires, Argentina, where the bribes were being paid. And the guy would drive 15 hours in a pickup truck or something, or in a minivan. And then he would get there, spend the night and drive right back 15 hours back with $200,000 in cash in the trunk of the car. And he would do this over and over and over again. That's the kind of thing they would go to. That's the length they would go to hide the bribes. But there's also bribes negotiated sort of in things that seem like in a mafia movie. There was bribes negotiated at abandoned gas stations in dangerous neighborhoods late at night with sort of a single light bulb hanging on a string. And we're talking about millions of dollars. And then there was betrayals in these bribe things where people would be taking bribes and their colleagues would think they were taking the same amount of bribe, but in fact, they had secretly negotiated a larger bribe and had kept the other one out. So it really ends up feeling, when you understand the culture of it, very much like something out of the Italian mafia or something.
People being bribed in Paul McCartney tickets.
Ah, yes, that's a good example.
Which may or may not have happened.
May or may not have happened, but there was
the concert, that is, may or may not have happened.
Right, so there was a trial in this case. The case... which came into public view, started in 2010, came into public view in 2015, and went to trial in late 2017. One of the people was alleged to have taken bribes as VIP tickets to rock and roll shows. And as a fun side note, during the trial, which I covered, I went to the bathroom once, and in the sort of in front of the sink was this defendant who was being accused of taking tickets to Paul McCartney shows. And the rumor had been flying around that Elton John was his favorite artist, and we started talking, and he started telling me how much he loved Elton John and that his best friend was a huge Billy Joel fan. It was really surreal to be at the federal trial of this guy, and he's telling me about Elton John. In any event, he was allegedly taking bribes in part in the form of $10,000 VIP tickets to this concert, and his attorneys, the prosecution was talking about this, his attorneys refused to admit that concert ever took place. Not that he took the bribes. That was for the jury to decide. But whether the concert even took place, the defendants wouldn't stipulate to that. And the rules of evidence in court say you can't just stand up and show a Google page and say this happened. So they needed a witness to attest to the fact that the concert was real. And so the prosecution, which was tired of fighting with this very resistant defense, called a very unusual guest. They called one of the Jonas Brothers. So in what was kind of the most bizarre moment of a very bizarre trial, Kevin Jonas, the Jonas Brothers, was a government witness, and he testified to the fact that indeed there was a concert. He had been in Buenos Aires with the rest of the Jonas Brothers to go. They were performing the next night, and Paul McCartney had invited them to the show. So his time on the stand lasted about 3 minutes. The defense had no cross-examination, and it was over. And the jury, you could see their heads spinning. It was a bizarre little moment.
So it's kind of absurd, and I catch myself laughing about it a little bit. But so maybe I should stop for a moment and say, for people who don't take this that seriously, don't care who wins the World Cup or who hosts it because it's just a game, will you make the case why sports corruption matters a lot?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, well, obviously, if people care about the sport, it matters because it affects the way they think about it. But beyond that, we can think about the social and public good of sport as an institution, right? Sometimes we think about sport only in terms of it being where the pros play in the World Cup or the different tournaments, but also one of the concepts of soccer as it's envisioned under FIFA. FIFA is the organization that oversees all world soccer. One of the concepts is to develop the sport and make it accessible to as many people as possible. One of the ways we could think about that is children playing the sport, women playing the sport, amateurs who just want to play for a good time. And all this corruption we're starting to talk about denies money that could go and filter down to these groups. And so we may not care about the sport writ large, but we all sort of might agree that little kids, if they want to play it, and I'm not just talking about here in Seattle and, you know, in Kirkland or something, but children in South Africa, children in South America, children in different parts of the world that don't have a lot of resources should be given the chance to do it. And I can tell you, having traveled a lot, particularly in South America, there's many children who have no resources, no fields to play on, no cleats to wear on their feet, no balls. There are 200 plus countries, as I said before, that play men's soccer at the highest level, but only about four dozen that play women's soccer at the highest level. It's an obvious iniquity. And one of the reasons is because a lot of countries don't put the resources they could into developing the women's game. So women are prevented from having the sport. Another reason, and this is one of the reasons that the Department of Justice would enunciate, is that this is the way that the corruption is conducted is through international money laundering and through defrauding financial institutions. And their argument is we should care about the crime in the sport because it's a crime the way we care about other crimes. They are taking advantage of institutions we're supposed to have faith in to commit crimes, to launder money, to hide it. I mean, you may recall the Panama Papers from a couple of years ago. This is all intimately tied into it. Many of the people whose names came up in the Panama Papers are also involved in FIFA corruption. And the law firms, the Panamanian law firms that were doing these deals, were part of their book of business was hiding money for soccer corruption. And a final piece, of course, is that there's an international sort of geopolitical piece of this. It's very hard to separate the way the soccer operates from a lot of geopolitical stuff. And we may discuss that later in this time, but so many events over the last few decades that seem to have a political scale end up having a small piece that's soccer. And people who end up as world leaders often start out in some of these countries in soccer. As an example, the current president of Argentina got his start as the president of the country's most popular soccer club. The former president of Honduras was indicted in this case, and a sitting member of Guatemala's Supreme Court was also indicted. So people who go on to bigger and better and more important things are often tied up in this web of corruption.
This is Ken Bensinger. The book is Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. So some of us may remember 2015, these high-profile arrests, a hotel in Zurich, and money laundering and racketeering. How, basically, in a nutshell, how did that scandal come to light?
It came to light because of the arrest, right? It had been a secret investigation.
I should say, what got that investigation rolling? What led to that?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting story, and it was one that the government tried to keep secret for a very long time. But back in 2010, which seems like decades ago, there was interest inside the FBI, which was then directed by Robert Mueller, to search for transnational crime, what he called transnational crime, which had to do with different kinds of financial crimes across borders. And an FBI squad in New York that specialized in Russian organized crime was looking for cases. And they had been building a case involving an illegal poker room and gambling ring, online gambling ring, sports gambling, that was housed partially in the Trump Tower in New York. And they had a wiretap in the Trump Tower, and they were doing all kinds of looking at how this was involved. And it turned out that the person who was financing it all, sort of the ringleader of this whole operation, was a Russian gangster. And this Russian gangster, they were trying to get information on him. He had been previously indicted in the U.S. for, of all things, bribing figure skating judges at the 2002 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City so that Russians would win and beat people from other countries. And so these FBI agents, there was an FBI agent who had spent his career busting the Genovese Italian crime family in Brooklyn, had moved to the Russian crime squad. He goes to London to find information about this Russian gangster. While he's there, he meets, he's introduced to a former MI6 British spy. And that spy has the name Christopher Steele.
Yeah. Steele dossier.
Christopher Steele at the time had just left the MI6, was not a particularly well-known and not at all known figure at the time, but he was a real expert in Russia. And they met together, and the FBI agent says, I'm interested in cases involving Russia and transnational crime. If you hear anything, let me know. Goes back to New York. And a few months later, Christopher Steele calls him up and says, you should come back to London. And the reason he did this is because one of Christopher Steele's first clients in private practice was the English Football Association, their soccer association, which was bidding to host the 2018 World Cup, the one we just saw in Russia. England had been competing against Russia and a few other countries to have this right. And they had hired Chris Steele to do research on the different bidding countries, in particularly Russia. What Chris Steele was finding was that Russia was cheating, essentially, that Russia was doing anything it could to win the World Cup and breaking all kinds of FIFA rules, definitely, but potentially international laws or different laws in different countries. And he says to the FBI agent, you might want to look into this FIFA thing. The FBI agent had never even really heard of FIFA, but it sounded like the kind of thing he wanted to do. He went back to Brooklyn and opened a case, went back to New York and then found a prosecutor in Brooklyn who would take the case. And that's how it began. So it really began as an investigation of Russian corruption and Russian attempts to use FIFA and to co-opt FIFA rules to steal the World Cup, which ultimately was successful. About 6 months after the FBI opened its investigation, FIFA held its vote. And lo and behold, although everyone thought England should have sort of on technical merits hosted the World Cup, Russia won the World Cup. And the FBI agents who were just beginning to build up their case felt vindicated in their idea and really started pushing ahead hard at that point. So that's the origin story of the case.
Okay, so we've just heard the names Robert Mueller, a Trump Tower, Russian gangster, Russian meddling, Christopher Steele of the famous Steele dossier regarding what Russia might have on Donald Trump. There are more coming up in your book. James Comey is in there, et cetera. Vladimir Putin. What are the parallels between this investigation, the FIFA soccer investigation, and the special counsels?
Right. Well, one obviously is the roots with Russia and Christopher Steele. Christopher Steele ends up being at a important fulcrum in both cases. There's no doubt that the FIFA case, as it's called, the U.S. criminal investigation of soccer corruption, would never have started without Christopher Steele. And we can think of him creating what you might think of as a FIFA dossier to provide information to the FBI. Mm-hmm. That's also critical because it creates a relationship between him and the FBI and this particular FBI agent. And it turns out the FBI, they're not particularly trusting folks. It's hard for them to build relationships with people and just take information cold. The FBI gets thousands of tips all the time that it completely disregards because it doesn't know who the source is and doesn't trust them. That's really important and pivotal later when, in 2016, Christopher Steele has this dossier of things he thinks Trump and Russia might have done together to sway the election, because he already has this relationship with the FBI. And if he didn't have that existing relationship, it's very clear, very likely that they never would have taken the dossier seriously. And you start spinning, the dominoes falling from that are pretty massive. If the Steele dossier didn't exist or wasn't taken seriously by the FBI, it's hard to imagine that many of the things we've been seeing over the last year and a half happening could have ever happened. I'm not saying there's not other evidence that is at play, because of course there is. And we've learned, for example, that this guy, Papadopoulos, for example, may have even triggered the investigation prior to the FBI having the dossier. But it's also clear, as we've seen from things like the FISA warrant on Carter Page, that so many pieces of this investigation wouldn't exist without the dossier playing a role. So that's really critical. And then, of course, Mueller being involved, Mueller's entire philosophy of fighting crime was at play in creating the FIFA case. And that same philosophy is clearly at play now in the special counsel investigation that he's leading. This week, we're supposed to see the criminal trial of Paul Manafort begin. Mm-hmm. If you look at the way that case seems to be constructed, it's very similar to the way the FIFA case was constructed, which is a money laundering case, which is following money between countries. We see the money from the Ukraine going through all kinds of middlemen, through Cyprus and elsewhere, and then ending up with Manafort. It's very similar to the way that the FIFA criminals are doing something. And so there's kind of a dialogue, if you will, between those two things. It's also not an accident that many prosecutors who had a small to medium-sized hand in the FIFA case now work under Robert Mueller. The lead prosecutor in the FIFA case does not, but his supervisor works for Mueller now. And a woman that the lead prosecutor in the FIFA case supervised, she now works for Mueller. So many of the people who were trained in the Eastern District of New York, which is Brooklyn, in a similar way of busting mafia, are all working for Mueller. And that's very much a spirit in that investigation.
So then, Ken, does your extensive knowledge here that began with the soccer investigation, does that tell you anything that you want to tell us about what to expect from the Mueller investigation?
Right. I don't have a crystal ball on those kind of things. And I often feel like every day one has a different emotional feeling about what's going to come out of that investigation. But I think it's pretty clear that there is a playbook to these kind of cases. We're seeing it writ large. I mean, in the FIFA case, the goal was to roll people, get enough evidence on people that they could turn them into cooperating witnesses. That is to say, sort of informants, as we might say in street language, to flip these people and make them do the dirty work, give the information, secretly record people, and then roll the thing forward to get more people. And using indictments, not just as a statement of what they've done research on, but actually to create more criminal acts and to create more investigation material to use. That's how they did the FIFA case. That seems to be how they're doing the Mueller case. So I think, it's clear that there's a strong effort to try to get people to flip, and there's a strong effort to use financial records and now apparently recordings, just like was the case in the FIFA case, to potentially prove to a jury what they believe to be true.
Again, we're talking with Ken Bensinger, and the book is Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. So you talked about how the Russia World Cup was ill-gotten in a sense. But the cup, as we just saw it played, was post-scandal, so it was squeaky clean?
I don't think anything in FIFA, unfortunately, is squeaky clean.
Oh.
A good example of that would be our friend Vladimir Putin. It's clear that he played a dirty role in getting the World Cup to Russia, which was an important priority for him. In 2010, he was prime minister. He had stepped down from the presidency because of their rules about re-election. Wanted to run again, wanted to be able to win the World Cup so that he could, in 2012, when he ran for president again, sort of hold that up as a reason to vote for him. It was successful. And then he wanted the World Cup as a way to project to the world, after he'd won domestically, his power. He wins re-election a second time, or however many times, if you add it all up, in March, 75% of the vote, which is an incredible number if you think about it. And now the World Cup is his chance to show the world what he's done. Well, one of the most sort of laughing at the world moment, I think, of the World Cup was when Putin invited the former president of FIFA to come to Russia and be his personal guest. That's important because the former president of FIFA had been kicked out of the game by FIFA in the wake of the U.S. criminal investigation. His name is Sepp Blatter, and he was so wrapped up in all this corruption, he had no choice but to resign, and then was kicked out of the sport for 6 years. The rules of soccer say that if you're kicked out of sport, you're not supposed to go to any events, but Putin didn't care. He invited him anyway and really thumbed his nose at the world. And we don't really know how deep the corruption was in the Russian World Cup. FIFA hired an outside lawyer, a former American prosecutor, to run an investigation of the World Cup bidding at that point. When they visited Russia to ask them to see their books, to see, explain where all the money went, whether there were bribes, Russia said, well, it's a funny thing. The computers we used for the bid were borrowed. And after the World Cup was over, we returned them to their owner, and they were destroyed. There's no records left. Isn't that sad?
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, it turns out they were borrowed from one of Putin's best friends, right? And they were completely destroyed. And FIFA's response was, well, you know, if there's no records, there must not have been any corruption. And they gave him a clean bill of health. We'll never really know. It's very clear that shady things happened. One more example, if I can. Egypt, which was playing against Russia, which for those who follow the sport, Russia did very much better as a team than everyone expected.
Yeah.
Egypt, they played in the first round, had a superstar, maybe the best scorer in the world right now, a guy named Mohamed Salah. That they're practicing prior to the World Cup, where they warmed up and trained, was in Chechnya, which is a dictatorship run by one of the scariest people in the world. And there's all these pictures of the guys practicing with the dictator looking over their shoulder and as personally escorting Salah to and from matches. Well, lo and behold, Russia beat the pants off of Egypt when they play them in the first round. So at the very least, there's incredible material for conspiracy theorists.
Mm-hmm. And what was, since I mentioned it at the beginning, what was Seattle's little tiny piece of the money laundering scandal?
So there's all these deals we talked about before where there's rights being ceded for probably below value because of bribes being paid. One of these bribes was a $200,000 bribe that was paid by a media rights company out of Miami to some Central American, Guatemalan, I believe, soccer officials. And the way to hide the money, rather than wiring it to these people directly, was to send it through intermediaries. In this case, it was a construction firm here in Seattle. And so in 2014, in March, about $200,000 was wired from a bank in Miami through a U.S. construction firm in Seattle and then off to Central America. And so it's a small but important role. And the government used that to prove that particular conspiracy. And, you know, prosecutors came to Seattle. Everyone was interviewed at the construction firm, that sort of thing. So it really reached as far as here.
There was a lot of money washing around in Seattle construction.
Apparently, yes, there was. I mean, it's right. It's a good place to hide money because there's a lot of money washing through the industry.
Yeah. Has this corruption, one last question maybe, has this, all this soccer FIFA corruption, does it seem to affect how much people love the game? Like, just for example, in Seattle, it doesn't seem to affect how Seattleites feel about the game, as far as I can tell. I'll just put it that way. Is it a cancer on the game? You know, they describe scandals as being like that.
I mean, I think it is a cancer in the game, and I think it is bad for the sport. But I think one of the ironies of it, and one of the reasons that these people could get away with it for so long, which they did, and why there's so much impunity in the sport, is because people love it so unabashedly. And when the World Cup comes around, for example, everyone forgets all their grumbling about how corrupt it is and just gets engaged in this tournament. And I don't know the numbers, but several billion people or eyeballs watch the World Cup tournament.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, I went to the Sounders game yesterday and I had a great time. I went with my son and there was 40,000 people there and it was fun and the Sounders won 3-1 and that was terrific. And so, you know, I think there's a hope. I think the prosecution felt this way too, which is, can we separate the fact that the sport can be a good thing and just the people who are running it are not so good, and can we get that cancer off of it and keep the body alive, right? Can you save the patient essentially and get rid of the problem? And that's the hope. And I think that's what fans want. I mean, there's a lot of people who are upset about the corruption and they feel like it's afflicting their love of the game, but at the same time, they love the game in its purest form. And so really, that's one of the reasons is that FIFA was never indicted. FIFA itself was never indicted. All these executives and officials of it were, but the sport, it wasn't. And that was a clear choice, which is to say, we can save this patient. We can save soccer. It's not going to happen overnight. We can reform it. We can push it. We can make it make changes. And over time, we can dream that it'll be a much cleaner thing.
Ken Bensinger is a Seattle native, a Sounders fan, a BuzzFeed investigative reporter, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and the latest book is Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. It's been great talking with you, Ken. Thanks for coming in.
It's a pleasure. I want to say if people are interested, I will be reading tonight at Elliott Bay Books on Capitol Hill. The reading's at 7 o'clock tonight, and we'd really love people to come out and see me read. I'll be there answering questions after I read a little bit and signing books. And if you really want up for it, we might go around the corner and grab a drink, and I can talk to you about soccer all night long. So hope people can make it tonight.
That sounds like a good night. Ken Bensinger, Elliott Bay Books tonight, 7 o'clock. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
More with the record coming back in just a moment. It's the record on KUOW. We are live tweeting the show at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Our relationship has changed, Seattle. I love you, but I'm going to have to be okay with not being in love with you. So writes columnist Tyrone Beeson in an essay for Pacific Northwest magazine. The essay's titled, I Hate You, Seattle, A Love Story. It's about the changing feelings the author has as Seattle morphs, he says, beyond recognition. We've got two guests who lived in the Seattle area for decades, so we're going to talk about that essay and a couple other stories that caught our attention this weekend. Casey Champion is a software engineer, a program manager at Microsoft's Imagine Academy, a lecturer at the UW in computer science. Welcome, Casey.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Gio Kabuyan, MC Geologic of the hip-hop duo Blue Scholars, also known as rapper Prometheus Brown. Gio, thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
Gio, you basically agree with this writer who's fallen out of love?
Yes, very much so. As I read through it, I found myself agreeing entirely with it. And similar timelines, too, with entry point in the mid-90s. Those are my first memories of being around Seattle and the music, the culture, the food, the neighborhood characteristics. I remember being drawn in by that. And then also a lot of the self-critical parts about how there was a Seattle before him that had changed. And I was definitely recognizing that as well. And then also what he says at the very end, which is that it's half defeatist, half optimistic. It's a little bit of both. But at the end of the day, those of us who are here still have the power to shape the city the way we want.
Yes, thank you. We'll talk about what we could actually do beyond complain, because I love complaining.
Yeah.
But there's more. Casey, what was your take on, well, I mean, you didn't need this one essay to get you thinking about this, but where
truth,
do you stand?
Yeah, very true. I feel like I think about this every day I step out of my door. Mm-hmm. I live in the U District, like a real grown-up, I guess, and two of the gas stations that would normally be there just have these giant holes. They're going to be like 24-story apartment buildings, and I live in this tiny little beautiful apartment built in 1923, and I just think about how I'm going to permanently be living in the shadow of these things. And I'm so happy because I was a student at UW and I know how hard it was to find housing. And I'm so glad we have more opportunities here. But it doesn't make me any less upset that my favorite Italian bakery isn't in South Lake Union anymore. And it breaks my heart so much. And especially as a software engineer, I'm one of the few that are from here. And I have so many colleagues coming from all over the world. And I'm so excited to share this beautiful city with them. Let's go to South Seattle and have some amazing Ethiopian food. Let's go to North Seattle. This brunch place is going to it's to die for. And they just don't really get out. When you're new to a city, you just sort of show up. And I just feel like all of these transplants haven't been doing as much work to integrate themselves in our community. And I try so hard as a software engineer to try and be a bridge for them. But they don't get why I'm so sad to see the changes, because I just think all of these people and all this culture and this art that is the reason that I fell in love with the city as a teenager, it just is slowly escaping.
Why do you is it they don't get it just because they're new, or is there what can you bring us from the land of software engineers as far as how is that a useful label to think about how you look at the growth and change and income situation, everything in Seattle?
I mean, I think we have to be very real. The majority of people, like when I think about Capitol Hill, you know, for me growing up on the East Side, Capitol Hill was like Mecca. We would come, we would go to Dick's on Broadway, and we thought we were the coolest kids around. We would go to the bars. Yeah, right? Yeah, me, a little nerd from, you know, the computer science class. And then I just look around Capitol Hill and it looks nothing the same. And it's because we have all of these, bless them, but 22, 23, 24-year-olds coming, and they're making six-figure salaries, and Amazon's giving them these massive cash bonuses, and they're like, what are you going to do with that kind of money? You're going to find what's the cool neighborhood. You're going to spend it on fancy housing and fancy food. And your lifestyle is so comfortable, you don't have to go out of your way to be like, hey, let me find a more affordable meal that's made by a family. Like, you're going to go to things that make you feel comfortable, that are easy. And a lot of those places are pretty bougie. And that's who's taking in the money. And so I think it's hard to show up in a new city and not have somebody that wants you to integrate when you have your own community that's sort of building up this whole separate transplant culture. And so I just feel like we're missing a bridge. We're missing sort of like old Seattleites to come into that community and be like, hey, there's places, guess what? There's places outside of South Lake Union that you can go eat and like go explore and like let's go check out art and stuff. Like I think a lot about Lambert House and how like what it meant for Lambert House to try and get forced out of Cap Hill, and how we're leaving the LGBTQ community behind with all these transplants. And I just wish people maybe got a little more invested in their community, but I think we also have to reach out.
You mentioned a bridge. How can we reach out? How do we build that bridge, Gio?
I don't know. I feel like it shouldn't be on us who've been here to always carry that burden. I think the folks who come out here, they carry a lot of what they left behind, wherever they're from, with them here. And
so what are some solutions? You had some in mind.
Yeah.
You said there's nothing we can do.
I agree that there should be moving out your comfort zone. I mean, you already left some comfort zone somewhere to come to a new place. Why not extend that further and explore outside your neighborhood, have conversations with people? It's not that hard, I don't think. But it does take time. Yeah, but I think on our part, we accept this reality, but we don't, I don't know. Yeah, you know, I think about it every day. But food, music, culture, that's probably the starting point for a lot of folks. So I like to concentrate on having those things, because we could talk abstractly about culture, but unless you're actually in the community doing these things, creating these spaces where there are meeting grounds. And for me, I see a lot of it in food and music. Maybe we could start there.
Well, that's going to be an ongoing conversation. I want to get in before we go. We were talking about some of the things that happened this weekend. Casey, you brought us a story about Amazon's facial recognition software. The ACLU used it on the faces of members of Congress and said it mistakenly identified 28 members of Congress with people who'd been arrested. What happened?
I assume we're all somewhat familiar with facial recognition software because Facebook is so insistent on making sure you tag everybody in your photos. Mm-hmm. But unsurprisingly, like most softwares that say detect something about an individual where their background might come into effect, like say voice recognition software, predominantly works less effectively on the type of people that we see less represented in tech. And so within that, I want to say that people of color represent 20% of members of Congress, but like 39% of the misidentified people with 39% of the misidentified people in this project. And I'm like, yeah, obviously. because you know who's testing, whose faces they're putting in front of this thing to test it all the time? The people that are working on it. It's the same reason that voice recognition software works way less effectively for women, because our voices tend to be higher and we tend not to be in the room of people developing it. It makes me think a lot about the seatbelt and how women suffered so many more fatalities in the early years of development of the seatbelt because they weren't putting women's bodies in there to test it. And so if we're at a place in time where we're starting to talk about using this type of technology for legislative purposes, my goodness, we better make sure that we are actually seeing real representation in the development of these technologies from the holistic population that they're going to affect.
And final story, just in our last minute, Gio, we're talking about the show box, maybe being saved, but maybe being torn down.
Yeah.
And I heard that your first show at the show box is a memory of having bombed.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, my first few, I don't know how we kept getting invited back to perform there. But yeah, from our first, I think we were playing a variety show, and we tried to bring a guitar on stage, even though that's not what we do.
Uh-huh.
I don't know why we thought that was a good idea, to opening up for De La Soul a year later,
nice.
And committing the cardinal sin of performing over one of their instrumental tracks before they got on stage, and getting yelled at for it as soon as we walked off stage, to headlining, to Mayor McGinn coming out to our show, to the crazy stuff that happened backstage, which shall go unmentioned. I would hate to see it go. And if it does, it would just be another indication of the trends that we were talking about earlier in this conversation.
Right. Gio Kabui and half of the hip-hop duo Blue Scholars, Prometheus Brown, here with software engineer and Microsoft Imagine Academy program manager, UW lecturer Casey Champion. Thanks for coming in, talking about the weekend and life here in this changing place. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for tuning into The Record on KUOW, produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Allison Bruzek, Sophie Reed, Jason Pagano, social media producer Kara McDermott. I'm Bill Radke. Tomorrow, actress and comedian Lauren Weedman joins me to talk about her new show. Lauren Weedman doesn't live here anymore. Speaking of change, join us tomorrow.